You're listening to The Cowboy Pages. Come with me, Christy Crowley, as I travel America in search of cowboy poets and their wisdom. Today's book, South Dakota, Chapter 3, Don't Second Guess Yourself. A chat with rancher and poet, Linda Hazelstrom. I drove through the rolling terrain of South Dakota to meet with Linda Hazelstrom and attend a lecture on ranching she'd be giving to a group from the Rhodes Scholar Program. Her audience was primarily retired people, traveling through the Dakotas learning about this truly unique part of America. Her lecture was a real education in ranching, and her ability to seamlessly weave in her poetry to her encyclopedic knowledge of ranching made ranching actually come alive in my imagination. I was just on the sidelines, but I enjoyed watching her audience almost as much as I enjoyed watching Linda. She sure knows how to hold a room. After the lecture, we sat down for a quick bite and a little chat, and then it was off to her ranch so we could sit down and talk in more detail about her life as an artist and as a rancher. I am very fortunate to be sitting across the table from Linda Hazelstrom at Windbreak Ranch. Is that how you refer to your property, Linda?
Actually, no. It's Windbreak House Retreats.
Wonderful.
And we're in Homestead House, which is my parents' house. And that's the house that's been here the longest. It's the ranch house. And I built a house nearby. Wonderful. But the ranch is the Hazelstrom Ranch.
Uh-huh. This retreat house is absolutely beautiful. And we were talking a little bit before the show started that this was built in 1952,
In 1952 when my mother married my stepfather, when John Hazelstrom, when she moved down to this ranch. And it was built for us then.
And just so we know, you were not born here. You were born in Texas.
I was born in Houston, Texas. And my mother left my father when I was 4 years old, my biological father, and moved north to be with her mother and then found a job in Rapid City, South Dakota. So I got to South Dakota from Texas just in time for the blizzard of 1949, which was a very good introduction to what things were going to be like in South Dakota for the next 60 years.
I bet. And it, as I was driving out here, it feels, particularly in comparison to what I'm used to, it feels very remote. It feels like there's not a lot of people around, but that's probably not, in fact, the case.
Well, that's so interesting because, of course, to me, it's very busy right now. There is a highway going by half a mile away. There's a subdivision across that highway. There's a couple of subdivisions. So it's a lot less remote than it was when I was growing up here, when the highway that you were on was gravel. But it's still pretty remote compared to a lot of places, and I realize how lucky I am.
And as we know, I'm really here talking to you because you are a cowboy poet. But I'm wondering, you probably don't consider yourself a cowboy. How would you define your work?
I believe the term, well, the women at the Cowboy Poetry Gathering, the way they explained it to me was that cowboy is a verb. It's not a gender term, it's a verb. We cowboy, therefore we are cowboy poets. I refer to myself as a rancher, and I write about ranchers, and rancher is a non-gender specific term. So I prefer the terms that don't necessarily make the gender an issue.
Is there a difference to you, or could you explain the difference to me in being a cowboy versus being a rancher?
Yes. Historically, the cowboys are the ones that work for the ranchers. The ranchers are the ones that own the land.
Great.
My father would never have referred to himself as a cowboy, and in fact, he wasn't very good on a horse and didn't particularly like horses. But he was a rancher.
And so you grew up here on this piece of property. You grew up ranching.
Yes.
And how did that play into your education? Was it easy to get to school? Was that challenging?
It was sometimes difficult. My parents drove me part of the time. I went 6 miles to grade school. For a time, there was a bus that took us there. When we started to go to high school, then we also got a bus to go into Rapid City, which was 20 miles away, and there were a group of us who rode the bus. And then some of us got cars as soon as we were old enough to drive. I was 14 when I got my driver's license. You could do that then.
Wow.
And so there were a number of us who got cars and drove at the age of 14. So that was a different kind of responsibility, too,
for
to
sure.
have your car and to be able to to drive to school, and we had rules about it. But
And driving in some serious weather, I would imagine.
Driving in some serious weather, yeah. Although there were times when I didn't go to high school particularly. I remember one time, especially, when we had been moving cattle in a blizzard, and the blizzard, the ice had ice and snow was blowing so hard that my face had a lot of little cuts on it. And when I did go back to school, I said, the storm hadn't been as bad in Rapid City, but I said I had to stay home and help with the cattle. Well, the teachers believed me because my face had all these little cuts on it. They couldn't think of any other way I could have gotten them. Okay. So
I want to just jump back for a second because you brought up something interesting, which is the gender thing. And being a woman working in a somewhat male-dominated field, that's always interesting to me. And I think of ranching as being a man's work, but I'm sure that's not the case. And I wonder how that played into your life, and was that ever an issue? And did gender come up in terms of the work you did or the work you were asked to do?
There was always a contradiction. My father and I branded when we first got out here. He and I would be the branding crew. And he tried to make me leave the corral when he castrated calves. And after a while, I said, you know, this is just wearing me out. I'm spending all my time climbing over the corral fence and leaving the corral. You know, you're going to have to, you know. Other than that, he really didn't ever make any distinction. My mother was constantly trying to keep me in the house and make me do the women's work, and I wanted to be outside. And I was my father's primary help. And so he really didn't make any distinction. I did the work, whatever work I was capable of doing. I got a tractor when I was 14, too. I bought a tractor for me because that meant I could go out and mow and rake hay. And to me, that meant I was part of the workforce. I was now a responsible person. I had to behave like one. So it became a very good training for adulthood thing. But he never, he always told me that I was going to go to college. He didn't ever particularly indicate that I wasn't going to be doing just what the men were doing as far as ranch work until it came time for him to talk about inheriting his ranch. And at that point, he didn't. He was not clear in his mind, and he didn't want to leave it to me. But I was married, and I think it was partly that he was out of concern for what might happen to it if I had a husband that was not responsible.
Yeah. You know, there's a little nugget of something you said in there that was really interesting to me. There's kind of this conversation going around about these helicopter parents, these parents that sort of hover over their children. And what an interesting thing to feel like you had responsibility and that you were, that actually translated into accountability.
Yeah. And there was no question about it. I was accountable. I mean, and I don't remember that he ever gave me a speech about it. Well, I'm sure that he did, knowing who he was. You know, I had a car now. Cars can kill people. You can run over people. You can drive badly. I do remember the speech about drinking and not riding with people who were drinking and not letting anybody in my car who was drinking. Mm. So there were plenty of things that went with that, but and I was supposed to call at a certain time. And, of course, calling in those days was not a matter of the cell phone.
Right.
It was a matter of finding a place to call from. So, but it definitely, the two things definitely went together.
Linda, I wonder, too, about working on your ranch as a kid. Do you feel like that work was out of necessity, or was it just that your father was a feminist and liberated and wanted you out there?
No. No, he wasn't a feminist at all. But he didn't have any other choice. And I know he and my mother had probably wanted things a little better than he might have expected. They were both in their 40s when they were married, and she was used to having her own money and her own profession. So I think maybe he didn't quite realize how expensive it was to have a family. And we hired help at different times. But there was always a problem. I mean, one hired man drank. We had a kind of a bunkhouse that was pretty primitive. It didn't have a toilet in it or kitchen facilities, so the guy had to come in here to use the bathroom, and my mother had to cook for him. And that didn't last very long. And he also drank. So I think that that it became a matter of I was the best help he could get most of the time. He would hire day help once in a while. And then sometimes we just would have neighbors come and help. He helped his brother, and his brother usually had hired men, and so sometimes they would help us in return. But after a while, I think he enjoyed watching me learn things and become responsible. That was part of what he felt was his job, was teaching me how to be a responsible adult. And when you send some 14-year-old girl out in the pasture on a horse and tell her to bring back the bull and the cross-eyed cow and the two cows with the broken horns, and she does it, you know you've accomplished something. And I think that was something that he really enjoyed.
It's a lovely way to think about parenting, that mm-hmm. the mandate is about a responsible citizen.
And definitely not helicopter part parenting. My mother would have been more like that. She was very afraid of all kinds of things. Mm. But I sort of learned my capabilities. And I was also lucky. I never got hurt very badly, as badly as some people did.
Sure. I want to talk a little bit about what sort of happened to you next, which is you went on to school and went to university.
My father always said that I was going to go to school no matter what happened. In fact, he broke up an early relationship that the gentleman in question was sure was going to result in marrying me and this ranch. And my father said, absolutely not, you're going to college. So I did. I went to the University of South Dakota in Vermilion and majored in both journalism and English. I had interned at the Rapid City Journal for a couple of summers before I graduated. So I was very interested in journalism. And so I got a BA in English and journalism. And then I did get married and go to the University of Missouri in Columbia, where I worked on my master's degree while I taught at Christian College. And my husband at that time was working on a PhD. And we came back here after 6 years to try to put our marriage back together. That did not work. We were divorced and I stayed here.
So that then leads me to want to talk a little bit about your work as a writer. And you have an extensive collection of work. It's all really just so beautiful, and I'm excited to dig into it more and more. But I guess what is interesting to me about your work is that you're doing essays and poems and kind of working in these different ways. And I wonder about how do you know what's a poem, and how do you know what's going to be an essay, and how do you know what's going to be a...
Sometimes it becomes both. Sometimes I try it as both. I have some poems that started out as pieces of fiction or pieces of nonfiction, and the other way around. I have poems that I wrote, and then I decided that I needed more, and I needed to put them into an essay. This partly probably grows out of the fact that I was a teacher for quite a long time, through the South Dakota Arts Council, and in various other ways, and taught, I didn't ever really teach regular, I taught at the University of Missouri, I taught classes, and then at Black Hills State College, I taught some writing classes and literature classes, so I was sort of in the habit of being a teacher. And then I went to work for the South Dakota Arts Council and would go into schools and work with them on their writing. And all the time I was working on my own writing, but I gradually also came to think that to realize that very few people were writing about ranching as the way it was actually done. There were a lot of critics. I've always been an environmentalist, but there are an awful lot of critics in the environmental movement who are very anti-ranching without ever having participated in it. And then vice versa, there's a lot of ranchers who are very anti-environmentalist. And I felt like I occupied sort of a unique position in the middle, and that I could understand some of the environmental complaints and also some of the ranchers' complaints about environmentalists. So I started writing essays about what the reality is of ranching and how responsible most of the people I know really are about their cattle and about the land. We have to be. If we don't take care of the land, it doesn't take care of us. So
I was fortunate enough this morning to hear you speak about ranching to another group, and it was incredibly interesting to me and very informative. But one thing that really struck out was your explanation of how cattle is in our lives in all of these different ways that we don't realize. And I was not aware of that. And it you know, being in really like the hub of veganism in the Bay Area, that feels like a less real thing to me.
Yeah. Well, it's the fact that it's something that influences us in so many ways, and we don't even realize it.
Linda, I want to also ask you about, you know, you were talking again this morning, giving me a lot of great information about the kind of symbiotic relationship that a ranch can have, that all of these things work together on the ranch to make it happen in terms of the animals and the food that they're eating and how that all works together. You've also written quite a bit about the changes in ranching that have happened, and I wonder what you see on the horizon.
I don't know if I can talk really intelligently about that. I know some of the younger ranchers tell me how outmoded my methods are. But I also, some of the younger ranchers in this neighborhood are doing a lot of their work on horseback. And I think that's a very good thing. But they're more tuned into what the world markets are and national markets are and that sort of thing. I have paid more attention to the land and what goes on between cattle and the land and the animals on the land. I think in order for ranching to be successful and continue to preserve the land, we have to get rid of factory farming and that whole business of huge companies controlling so much of the food production that we have. We've allowed that. We've encouraged it. There's a whole political rant there that I'm not going to go into. But I think I really like the idea that there are a lot of individuals. You said something about people are interested in getting back to the land and learning where their food comes from. I think that's got to be a good thing, because if they really learn where their food comes from and they're interested in eating meat, they are bound to stumble over the fact that these Great Plains grasslands are such a treasure for just raising meat without a lot of extra attachments. Mm-hmm. We don't need to have cattle standing belly deep in manure in order to have healthy meat. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's much better if they're not. And they don't have to. And right now there are responsible stewards out here who know how to do that. We need to preserve the ranchers that are on the land that understand this grassland, as I was talking about this morning. One of the things we do wrong is send our kids off to college and they learn things, that professions that take them away from ranching. And that's a double-edged sword. Of course we want them to be educated, but if they move out of ranching and go into other lines of business, then they're not here to run the ranch responsibly. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, maybe it's good to have bankers with ranch backgrounds who understand how things work and who would be more sympathetic to people who wanted to be on the land. Sure. I'd just like to see things stay so that one-family ranches were still viable enterprises. And this country gives a lot of assistance to a lot of different kinds of business, but most ranchers don't get a whole lot. So I think it would be good. I'd like to see the state of South Dakota really do a program to encourage grass-fed beef that comes straight off the ranch and goes straight to the consumer without any middlemen.
Wow.
And so far that has not been done. I mean, it's a great possibility. We have people here that could do it, and it hasn't been done. Hmm. So.
I would like to go back, perhaps, and talk a little bit more about your writing. And there's not quite a question here just yet, but I think, not to put you in a box, but there's something particularly about your poetry that strikes me as being this beautiful juxtaposition between the kind of harshness of ranching, or the harshness isn't the right word, the kind of absolutes of ranching, and then this really beautiful feminine kind of sensuality around it. And by that I mean this very, I can feel and taste and hear what's in your poems. And I'm almost at the edge of a question here, but it's fascinating to me to so clearly feel this kind of female perspective. And I'm curious if you've heard other people recite your poetry and what that experience was.
I haven't. I know that some do. I ran into a young woman in Elko last year that does, and I haven't heard it. It seems to me I've heard one or two, and they didn't throw themselves into it the way I do.
Yeah.
But that may just be a matter of style. Sometimes with my poems, I can hear the voice of the person that I'm sort of, whose story I'm mm-hmm. telling. And sometimes it's not really the voice of that person, but it's a kind of combination of voices of people that I've known. But and this is on the edge of an answer. Yours is on the edge of a question. This isn't really... I don't know. I wrote one way when I got out of college. I was writing in a very master's degree way when I got out of college. I mean, I learned how to write poetry, right, by golly. And I was doing it. And it wasn't doing anything for me and probably wasn't doing anything for anyone else. And at a certain point, I had a breakthrough. And I know what it was and when it was. I had my first husband had departed, and one of my cousins was sent down as a delegation of one to find out if there was going to be a divorce in the family. Mm-hmm. And he and I, because this is what you do in the country, we didn't want to come in the house and sit down and talk. People don't do that. They do sometimes, but so I took him down to the garden, and we started weeding. And that was the idea. I headed down to the garden. And on the way, we walked by a new tulip bed that I had just put in. And the tulip bed was about 6 feet long and about 3 feet wide. And my husband stopped by, or my cousin stopped by the tulip bed, and he looked down on it and scratched his head and said, "Where did you say Dan went?" And the minute he left, I sat down on the back step out there and started writing the poem that became for me the breakthrough poem. A mulch is a layer of organic matter used to control weeds, preserve moisture, and improve the fertility of the soil. You will not find naked soil in the wilderness. I started cautiously. Newspapers, hay, a few magazines, Robert Redford stared up between the rhubarb and the lettuce. Then one day, cleaning shelves, I found some old love letters. I've always burned them for the symbolism. But the ashes, gray and dusty as old passions, would blow about the yard for days, stinging my eyes, bitter on my tongue. So I mulched them. Gave undying love to the tomatoes, the memory of your gentle hands to the squash. It seemed to do them good, and it taught me a whole new style of gardening. Now my garden is the best in the wilderness, and I mulch everything. Bills, check stubs, dead kittens and baby chicks. I seldom answer letters. I mulch them with the plans I made for children of my own, photographs of places I've been and a husband I had once, as well as old bouquets and an occasional unsatisfactory lover. Nothing is wasted. Strange plants push up among the corn, leaves heavy with dark water, but there are no weeds. And everything seemed to come together in that poem for me. Joke about whether, I mean, the sort of leaving it enigmatic about whether or not I mulched the photograph of the husband or the husband. the feminist viewpoint, the idea. Now, I didn't actually mulch any love letters until after I had written the poem. And I thought, you know, that's not a bad idea. But it just seemed to me to kind of have everything fit together that yes, I could learn a lot from the master's degree work I had learned from writing, but they also that I had to find my own style. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of my own style.
Thank you for sharing that piece. Thank you. And it's an example. It's a really great example of what I was trying to articulate before.
Okay,
and I think that that's part of what I find so... what hooks me about your work. And it's... I always think about art in terms of where do I feel it? Do I feel it in my head? Do I feel it in my throat? Do I feel it in my heart? You know, do I feel it in my guts? Where is it living in my body? And... your work really hits me in these very specific places. And I think, you know, that it hits me in my head and it hits me in my heart, but it also gives me this other feeling that sort of, it gives me hope, actually, I think is what it is, now that I'm trying to articulate it. And I think that hope is about, maybe I have a fighting chance of making sense of what it is to be a woman in the world. Because it feels a little unwieldy. And there, I am so grateful to my mother, who fought so hard to be paid anything like the men who did the same job she did. And I am even more grateful to the hundreds of women that fought so that I can do what I'm doing right now. But there are days when I think it's too much. There are too many choices. And I am going to screw this up, and I'm going to fail, and I'm going to let them down, and what if I don't become a mother, and what if I don't get married, and what if I don't, blah, blah, blah. You know, that just runs in your head all the time. And then I look at these little girls, and I think, what the heck am I going to say to them? Do you wear a short skirt? I don't know. Do you put on mascara? Beats me. Do you go on a third date? I have no idea. You know, it just, and so these poems where... it feels like you know how to stand your ground and also be a really beautiful, fluid woman is really reassuring.
I have to read you another one, and this is not mine. But this was one that I thought of this morning when this question came up, and it very much talks about exactly this question. This is by a writer named B.J. Buckley, who's from Montana, and it's from Woven on the Wind, which is one of the three anthologies I edited with two other women. From Wyoming. This was writing about women writing about friendship.
Mm.
And this is called A Man's Work. The day they called the lighter bar to tell us Norma Mallee'd had a heart attack, Joyce said it's because she's done a man's work all her life. And all the women nodded. She ranched on her own, did everything herself. It was too hard. Finally might kill her. All those women nodded. Young girls with faces already going leathery from sun and wind, from squinting into it to see some lost lamb in the blue sage, or to sniff out if that was smoke in the wheat or just some boy in a pickup throwing dust. Those women who rode and branded and cooked the damn testicles and nursed the kids and cleaned up after everything, who jacked stuck trucks out of the mud, who learned to pee from a horse as tiny girls because if they got off, they were too short to get back up again and they could be 20 miles from home looking for some antisocial heifer who ought to be ready to drop. Those women who mostly did what Norma did, who stayed and kept the ranches when their fathers died or their husbands ran off or their sons left, those women who called it man's work, who couldn't somehow call that work their own. I ran into Norma once on the dirt road behind Dead Man. She was on her hands and knees in the roadside weeds and wheat, her face flushed crimson, pouncing like a cat. She was catching grasshoppers in her heavy hands and popping them into a can with a lid. And I yelled, "What are you doing, Norma?" And she said, "Going fishing. Nothing like grasshoppers for going fishing. Half the time the fish leap out of the water to get them before you can wet your hook." So I helped her, while Norma, who never much said two words, spoke love for fish and her cows, and said she'd never wanted to do nothing else but ranch, even though she was a girl and was supposed to want other things. And here she was doing it, and how many folks got to do that their whole lives, exactly what they wanted. Now that's a poem I wish I had written. Because that is so absolutely correct about they do this work because they want to do this work, because they love this work. And they give up consciously or unconsciously plenty of other things I remember being 35 and thinking about all those choices you were just talking about. And I had just been divorced. And the chances, I believe, well, what were the statistics? Chances of getting married again were, you know, 50 to 1 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's when you start to make choices and say, okay, I'm not going to do this, but I'm going to do this and take the consequences.
So if you could sit your 20-year-old self down and give her a piece of advice, what would you tell her?
Don't marry that one would be one of the first pieces of advice. Don't doubt yourself so much. Mm-hmm. But I also don't think that it would do the slightest bit of good to sit my 20-year-old self or your 20-year-old self down and tell us that, because I think that's what everybody goes through. Maybe there are a few people who don't, but I think people do, and you stumble around. And if you're lucky, your mistakes don't kill you or render you totally incapable of recovery. If you're lucky, you say, oh, well, that wasn't fun. I don't think I'll do that again. But we all know people who do it again and again. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have empathy for those people because we understand how it happens.
But I will say this self right here can benefit from hearing don't doubt yourself. It's a good thing to remember.
And don't second guess yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I've practiced for a long time is if I'm having a difficult time making a decision, I say, okay, I've decided this is what I'm going to do. And then when I wake up in the morning, I think, how do I feel about having decided that? If I wake up and say, oh my God, then I'm not going to do it. And I didn't tell anybody, so I don't have to do it.
That's a good strategy.
If I wake up in the morning and think, did something like that just recently, and it was really nice to wake up in the morning and think, I don't have to do that, because I told him no. I said I'd make the decision today.
It's a good tool.
So,
in talking more about your work, how do your poems come to you? Is it line by line? Is it a nugget of an idea that builds? For the individual?
Both of those ways. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a line, sometimes it's in a story. The poem I read this morning, I heard that line. He didn't know, he died, young and hard and bad. That's all I had to hear. I looked at those two guys, they realized I was listening, I turned away so that I wouldn't necessarily hear it, and I didn't hear it. And the two of them went on talking, and I made all the rest of it up. And sometimes it's a story. I've got a story about a homesteading couple, and my father told me the story, and I just pretty much wrote the story as he told it to me. Because, as I said this morning, I tell my story to some extent, but I'm a lot less forthcoming about my own history than I am about other people's histories. Because I sort of consider part of my job to sort of be representing ranching for the people that won't get this written. And I don't do it by, I very consciously don't do it by trying to write up-to-the-minute articles about statistics and what's going on in ranching. That's just not something I'm interested in doing. And things with statistics, it changes every 15 minutes anyway. By the time I got it done, it would be different. So I'm trying to represent the sort of the heart and the soul and the viewpoints of the people. It was interesting when Windbreak, my first book, came out, the diary, no one around here admitted to having read it. But a couple people did come up to me and say, you know, thanks for writing those things. Mm. Thanks for writing it. My uncle called me and said, you know, you mostly got that right. Which I thought was pretty high praise from him.
And just for those folks who have not had a chance to read Windbreak, it is a year-long journal.
It's a year-long journal. And it actually, the truth of it is, and this was my very first book, So the truth of it is it's taken from multiple years because I wanted to represent a year on the ranch, and not everything happens every year. All of the entries came from my journal. They didn't all come from the same year journal. And one of the things that I learned from that book, I published this book with a small press in Berkeley, California, and I had at that time not met the woman. Mm. And we worked, sent the manuscript back and forth for 4 years. She suggested that for the sake of rounding the book out, it ends with a prairie fire, that I start it with a prairie fire. And I really didn't give it that much thought. It starts in September. We had had plenty of prairie fires in September. I just moved the information about one fire to September. The first week after the book was published, I think, I was in the Hermosa post office, and somebody said, I don't remember a fire that big in September. And I thought, oh my God. No, I changed it. I didn't tell, I lied. I didn't tell the truth. I changed it for the sake of the book. And it really woke me up to the fact that you can't do that if you expect people to believe you. Mm. So I'm stuck now. You know, I have to tell the truth. I can leave it out and say, this part is none of your business. Mm-hmm. But I can't lie about it because it's nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really disturbs me about when I was going into classrooms a lot about modern writing and some of the modern trends and some of the people who have written books that were taken as the truth and it turned out later they were not the truth, that makes it hard on all the rest of us, because kids ask me sometimes, well, this stuff really happened, is this true? Yes, that's what nonfiction means. Mm-hmm. But you only have my word for that.
Right.
And it angers me greatly that there are individuals writing who have made my word suspect, because they can't be trusted.
Yeah, fascinating. I also, there's such a trend now of these sort of memoir pieces, right? Mm-hmm. These memoir books. And where, you know, I'm really in this culture now where it's the me culture. I you know, we all have our Facebook page and our Instagram account and our blah, 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 blah. And there's, you know, this kind of talk around how we're all curating our lives, what it looks like from the outside. And so where is the distinction for you in what is a nonfiction and what is memoir? And how does that play?
Well, it's all, I have a Facebook page too. And of course, it's filtered through what I might say I'm telling the truth, but it's filtered through my own prejudices, my own beliefs, my own ideas. But if I'm writing about, the attitude toward branding or how we do branding or how we do fencing or the work that we do on the ranch, I have to take not only what we do into consideration, but I have to think about how my neighbors would feel about that.
Let me take you back to something that's really interesting to me in Windbreak in particular. The journal entries start with a kind of weather report, the high and the low, correct? Yeah. And it's so clear what that relevance is to you in your day-to-day. And it really struck me in reading the book because I talk about the weather to be polite.
Yeah.
Right? It's just conversation.
That's right.
It really doesn't play any big part in my day-to-day other than do I pack an umbrella or don't I?
And it doesn't necessarily affect what you do.
No. Mm-mm. No. And it's fascinating, and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about what it really is to live on the land, that the weather affects you.
We may have a plan, particularly when I was actively ranching. We would say, okay, well, if the weather's good tomorrow, let's bring the cattle back from over east. Well, you get up in the morning, and if it's 30 below zero, then the cattle are going to be miserable, the horse is going to be miserable, you're going to be miserable. Probably you're not going to bring the cattle back from over east. But it means that the weather could be, it means that their water is frozen over there. So we need to get over there and open their water so they'll have water, because they have to have it every day. So we have to make a decision. Okay, do we try to bring them back, even though it's bad weather. When we've done it, I remember doing this a few times when the snow got really deep. Things, my dad had a kind of an uncanny ability to know. Our east pasture was 6 miles away from here. Only way to get to it was through the pasture, through a pasture trail that could get drifted so deeply that we couldn't get through it. There was one winter when we accidentally left some horses and cattle over there. We couldn't find them. And it was months before we got back over there, and they survived. So we tried not to let that happen. So we would try to sense when it was going to storm and bring them back before. And my dad was very good at that. But I remember one occasion when we blew it, and it had been snowing and snowing and snowing, and the snow was just getting deeper, and there wasn't any indication it was going to quit. So we loaded up. We had a four-wheel drive at that time. It wasn't anything like today's four-wheel drives. And me on my horse, and headed over there, and we took, you know, extra coats and all that sort of thing, and called the cattle. In fact, this was probably the occasion which we ended up leaving them. We called them together. I would ride as far as I could ride, but the snow was very deep, and I didn't want to wear the horse out right at the beginning. And our east pasture is very rough, deep canyons. So we rode, and the cattle seemed to be all kind of in one area, and we kind of gathered them up and started. My dad was leading them in the pickup, and we came through the pastures, coming along there. And I remember at one point, two of the bulls got to fighting, and they were right at the top of a steep slope. And one bull got the other one kind of on the downhill and hit him, and the other bull just rolled over and over and just totally disappeared in the snow. The snow was like 3 feet deep, and I'm just watching him go down the slope. He got to the bottom of the slope, picked himself up, shook his head, and decided that it was time that he went home instead of having a big fight. So it actually was a good thing. But the cattle were just laboring through the snow, and so was I. And my feet were so cold. I have had frostbite any number of times. I mean, my fingers and toes today, you get them the slightest bit cold and they turn white. but we got the cattle home and got them safely home. And that was just a routine thing. I mean, we didn't want to do it that way. But once you're in that situation, we couldn't let them stay over there. It's your responsibility. I mean, that's part of the responsibility I was talking about. The cattle are our responsibility, and you don't just say, well, we'll wait till the weather gets nice. Mm-hmm. You have to do it.
So. Thank you. That is just puts it into a whole different perspective.
There it is. Bravery. That ability to confront our fears and attempt to be victorious over them. When I think of a kid driving a tractor in the snow, a young girl leaving her ranch to go to college, or a woman divorcing a man she knows she can no longer be with, when I think of the rancher caring for and playing champion to our animals, the writer who keeps putting pen to paper in search of the next great line or truth or tale, I'm amazed that these brave warriors can all live inside one woman. I don't think Linda is fearless, but I do think she's tenacious and wise. And perhaps these two qualities in concert lead to bravery. I wonder now, can I find this bravery inside myself? As I left Linda's ranch very early the next morning, 4:30 a.m. to be exact, I came to the end of her long dirt road and right up to the main drag. I was a little heartbroken to go so soon. I guess part of me wanted more of that brave spirit to rub off. But in that moment, I was also glad the only brave decision I had to make just then was whether to turn right or left. And thankfully, I turned right and onto other conversations with other cowboy poets. Thank you for listening. You can learn more about our show, Cowboy Poets, and see pictures of my travels at thecowboypages.com.